where you will find many of the leading edge thinkers in the world of continuous improvement, lean, service design, and sales and marketing. The podcast is sponsored by the Lean Marketing Lab, a learning community dedicated to developing and improving the user experience. When joining the lab, you will receive immediate access to the Marketing with Lean book series. Now, to the podcast. Welcome, everyone. This is Joe Dagher, the host of the Business 901 podcast. With me today is Karen Martin. Karen is a recognized thought leader and is internationally known for her lean work and her widely acclaimed workshops on white-collar Kaizen. She is co-author of the Kaizen Event Planner, and with her most recent book, The Outstanding Organization, she has launched herself to another plateau. I would like to welcome you, Karen, and congratulate you, and sorry for the pun, but for an outstanding book.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast again. It's great to talk with you.
Yeah, when I first started the book, I thought it was going to be another clarity, let's get focused book, but you surprised me.
How so?
Well, you had this, the most practical undertone that I have read in a long time that was about doing. And the first half of the book had so much more meaning after I read it. After I read the second half that I had to reread the first half. I don't think I got it all the first time.
You know, isn't that interesting? Because the concepts are so surprisingly simple, but yet there's a lot of depth to the whole topic around clarity and what clarity really is and how do we really achieve it and, you know, all the different elements. It is interesting that it sounds so seemingly simple, but yet there are a lot of layers to everything. The discipline part was the easiest to write from a prescriptive perspective because, you know, it was much of a step one, step two, step three. Clarity was tough to write about because there were so many different elements around clarity, and it's tough to give general solutions to problems that are very specific in organizations. So my goal in clarity was really to heighten awareness and offer a few tips on what to do to, you know, get rid of ambiguity and gain greater clarity. But it was really about just start paying attention to how unclear things are and then, you know, take the appropriate action based on that.
Usually I ask this at the end, but I'm interested in finding out your answer to this. What is the single most important message you would want readers to take from your book?
You know, I've been asked that actually a fair amount. And what I quickly said it the first time I was asked it in the middle of an interview was if I had to pick one of my four children, which is always difficult to do, I would say that it's focus. And it's because year in and year out for, you know, 20 plus years of doing this kind of work, I find that the thing that trips organizations up the most of all four of them is that they just have this, you know, this prevailing organizational ADD, attention deficit disorder, where they keep jumping from project to project before it's completed. And that jumping around creates such a high degree of chaos, and it drains the workforce of their, you know, psychic energy and their creative potential to be able to contribute, that to me, if you did nothing but focus on focus, that you would move your organization way far ahead.
Well, you bring up my next question and lead into it perfectly. Planning seems to be so taboo. Even the lean startup version of PDCA is build, measure, learn. You know, and planning, it just seems we're dropping the planning from the cycle. And is there still room for planning?
Oh, yes. And I'm so glad you asked that question, because I didn't end up, a lot of my content got on the cutting room floor because I had far more words than what my contract was for. One of the things I went into in detail that got cut was I'm frustrated with what's going on out there around planning. And there are a lot of people that are playing into it. So I touch on Gladwell's comments about planning, and I touch on other people and their kind of anti-planning zeitgeist that's out there. And I think it's just wrong. I mean, just wrong. Because I think what happens, and I mentioned this very quickly in the book, is that people have gotten the plan confused with the process of planning. And you know, and the criticisms that I keep hearing about planning is that, well, you know, the world is so fluid and you have to be flexible and agile. And, well, of course you do. But who said that once you get a plan in place, you may not ever under any circumstances deviate from it? No one said that. And yet that's how organizations have behaved. And so once again, we throw the baby out with the bathwater on an extremely robust and necessary part of performance, of performing well. And people say, forget the plans. We can't plan. And that's just wrong.
A well thought out plan is going to include the ability to adapt.
Well, right. That's what PDSA is, or PDCA. I mean, that is, it's about adapting based on current conditions. And so, you know, there's a lot going on even in the lean community that's kind of smelling as though people are saying, well, you know, stop with your plans and stop with your to-do lists and stop with this. I'm like, no. Don't stop with it. But use PDCA, PDSA as it was intended, which is being very present with what your experiments results are showing. You know, alter your hypothesis, go back, experiment again, and keep on adapting based on your new information.
Well, you brought up a good subject in the book, and it's about discipline. Mm-hmm. Could you explain what you mean by discipline as it relates to an organization?
Yes, thank you for asking that. So in a nutshell, it would be standard work. So, you know, standard work around decision making, standard work around problem solving, standard work around actual process improvement, and standard work in how work gets done. So it's really getting far more consistent so that you can become more predictable and reduce the variation that we ourselves create so that we have the bandwidth to deal with the variation that's just the nature of the beast and part of being in business. It's a methodical approach to how you schedule meetings and how you put a team together. And it's just being much more thoughtful and methodical about how decisions are made and work is done.
You know, and standard work always gets a bad rap. But to me, I think that most of everyone's days, including leaders, including looking at organizational health, is about standard work. So that's really, you know, what puts groceries on the table and the part that you need to concentrate on makes you you do well. And does that kind of what you're talking about, the focus and the chaos, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, lack of standard work is what causes chaos. It will never not cause chaos if you don't have some degree of standardization. So back to your point about standard work getting a bad rap, you know, I very much agree with you. It's been getting an increasingly high number of hits from people that are, again, not understanding what standard work is. So, you know, so I wish if people didn't understand what it was, they wouldn't talk about it, because they're confusing the people that are just learning about standard work and creating some negativity around it that's just not really very helpful. So here's my take on it. Standard work, overstandardization is as dangerous as understandardization. And what a lot of newbies to lean that got trained and got certificates and everything went out there and thought that standard work was the be-all, end-all. Well, it's not. So you have to have flexibility even within standard work to handle different conditions and different scenarios, but you can still standardize those different scenarios. And so, yeah, I mean, we could talk about standard work for the whole podcast.
You talk about discipline, but you talk about in a frame of organizational versus people, because discipline is not about, it's about people, but I mean, because an organization, but it really is the discipline of your organization, and that is what drives the chaos out of it.
Right. And so all four of the conditions I talk about are dealt with at an organizational level, understanding that an organization's a group of people. So it does start at an individual level, but it's more setting the system in place and the organizational psyche in place to enable individuals to behave the way they need to in order to get the organization to behave as it needs to as a whole. So it's, you know, it is definitely a holistic thing that I'm looking for.
Could you name the four and just fully describe them?
Sure. So the first one is clarity, and I couch that as the toughest to get, and it's clarity in thought, word, and deed. So it's clarity around what an organization's mission is. It's clarity around what the priorities are for the year, what the goals are for the year, making sure everyone understands them clearly, what they are. Clarity in language. so that when you have people sitting in a room together, they're actually speaking the same language, and you don't have, you know, someone, it's like having someone who speaks French only sitting there with someone who speaks Spanish only, and it's, you know, no wonder we don't communicate well. And it's clarity in roles and responsibilities. Who does what? Who exactly do you go to if you need to get input on blah, blah, blah? You know, those kinds of things. So focus. Focus is sticking with a plan of action until there are very compelling reasons not to. So it's everything from prioritizing projects and improvement priorities so that and getting consensus around it. So it's not just about prioritizing in one person's head. It's organization-wide consensus so that it's not as tempting to be distracted when new things come along and you get people, you know, moving together to completion and getting things done well before they move on. So that's focus. Discipline, we talked about a little bit already. So I would just add that disciplined problem solving is probably the ripest area I see for most organizations. They need to have methodology that everyone in the organization uses so that you get, you know, consistent critical thinking around and you eliminate or at least reduce the possibility of band-aids and the quote solutions not really being the solutions because the problem wasn't clear to begin with and there was no methodology for achieving that. And then last is the one that kind of sort of doesn't belong with the others, but it's a result of the others, and that's engagement. So this is deep employee engagement where they are actively involved in all of the decisions that are being made, not strategic decisions, but daily decisions. They are using their full creative potential much of the time versus the opposite that usually happens. And they are the ones that are solving problems at a tactical level versus, you know, those quote solutions being dictated to the front lines from managers who really don't do the work. The other thing about engagement that's critical is to get people looking at the whole organization holistically allows all of the interdepartmental tension that exists to melt away. And I see it over and over and over, and it's a beautiful thing when it happens.
Well, just to mention on the part on engagement, when I looked at the book, I couldn't wait to get to that section because I thought, here's where Karen and I are going to really butt heads. So we're going to have some different opinions here. And I'm not sure that I've read a better 40 pages on engagement.
Thank you, Joe.
And I know you spoke at the Human Resource Conference in Atlanta. Have you received feedback from human resource people on that chapter yet?
I have, not from that chapter in the book, but I did from my talk, which was based on the book. The HR folks that were in the audience loved what I had to say, very much believed that, you know, that I was spot on, but they don't feel that they have the ability to affect change in their organizations. So I may be developing a new mission, and my new mission may be to get HR departments positioned within organizations in a more effective way than they currently are so that they can regain some of the leverage that they used to have, you know, decades ago to play a significant role in operational performance improvement and business performance improvement overall. You know, they've just somehow they've gotten relegated to being order takers and transaction-based people about benefit plans and, you know, performance reviews and hiring and firing. And somehow they've been left out of the improvement loop in a not so helpful way.
One of the things that really caught my eye is because I use Zappos and Zingerman as a couple companies when I talk about building culture and people. And they go through great strides on who they hire.
Right, right, and yeah.
That's kind of like root cause just about, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I think it's really tempting. And I've been in this, you know, I've been in the hiring mode in my past a lot. It's common to refer to people in a disrespectful way as a, quote, warm body. But what I mean by that is it's very tempting to just get a warm body in the door because you've got a need that you need to fill and not be, you know, not take your time to make sure it's a very good match and that the person comes to the organization with the, you know, as full a complement of the kind of the thought processes in place that you need for the organization. It's tempting to just try to, you know, get the numbers filled.
When you talk about the engagement, you go in and you even bring pair programming into it. Briefly describe pair programming, but then can that practice be done outside of software?
Yeah, and in fact, the reason why I put it in the book was that I've been applying it in almost every industry there is, and it's so successful. So pair programming, for the listeners that may not know about it, it started in software development, and it's taking two developers sitting side by side with one keyboard and one monitor. One person's designated as the driver, the other person's designated as the observer or the navigator, and the driver is actually coding while the other person is watching it, looking ahead, looking for problems, and they're together actively problem solving real time. So it's kind of the two minds are better than one philosophy. The problem most organizations have with it is at first glance, it feels like you're doubling your labor expense, but you're not. Not even close. You're actually reducing expenses because when you count the number of labor hours that go into rework and delays in delivering and all the different things that happen when you've got one person writing code, it's a significant benefit to pair programmers together.
And does that help, I mean, bring more people together? I mean, because once you have two, isn't it easier to engage four?
Well, it's interesting. I've never tried it with three or four people together because I do think you get too many cooks in the kitchen. But I do think that the pairing, what's being done sometimes when I suggest pairing isn't really what's meant by pairing. So it's not taking someone with a very well-developed skill set, pairing them with someone with a very undeveloped skill set. That's not the primary use of pairing, although you can use it that way to build skill sets, and you do develop skill sets when you pair any two people together, but that's not its primary purpose. Its purpose is to problem solve real time, catch errors as they're occurring, and get a more robust product out, as a result. So the people that are working together get this greater sense of confidence in their own ability because they're producing better work and they're learning as they go and they're learning problem-solving skills. And you're getting a significant long-term benefit in developing the workforce that way. They're fully engaged. They can't be disengaged when they're in a pair.
When we talk about, current employees and the current organization, is this one way of creating and introducing engagement to them?
By the pairing,
Yes.
I'm not sure that I use it as my primary, or my first approach to engagement. Actually, Kaizen events are usually what I turn to first show them how deeply engaged they can get the workforce and how excited people get around work and an improvement as a result of Kaizen event participation. But pairing, I actually almost always turn to pairing because of a quality problem. And the engagement part of it happens to be a side benefit, but it's very tactical to solve a quality problem. So, for example, in a hospital setting, I was working with these nurses in doing medication reconciliation at discharge. High stakes, high risk process, often done poorly, and people can die as a result of it. So it's pretty big deal. Nurses were, in my clients, they were always doing this alone. And it's a very complex process to look at all the meds someone came into the hospital on, all the ones they had while they were in the hospital, and what their physician or physicians are suggesting they're on when they leave home, leave the hospital. So it's a complex process. And what happens is, first of all, it's complex, so one person has a hard time seeing everything and getting it done well. But then there are always these interruptions. And so by pairing two people together and putting them in a bit of a cone of silence, as I call it, then they're able to have two eyes on a very complex task, and they're able to do it without interruption, and the quality of that task then goes through the roof. And so that's just one example. I've used it in financial services. I've used it in engineering design for different pieces of a process, and it's wildly successful.
Well, you have hosted and facilitated as many Kaizen events as anyone, I would imagine. And they seem to have a bad rap a little bit at the moment, okay? Are they needed? Are they a good way to introduce something?
Yeah, and the bad rap, just like the bad rap for planning, I think a lot of people give things a bad rap when they haven't really experienced what's good about it. And so the bad rap I think comes first from people who've never experienced a good Kaizen event, and also from those who have, you know, grown up with a very pure view of Toyota production systems. And you know, Toyota does use them, but they don't use them extensively because they've got a culture that can solve problems and get rapid results in another way. Organizations that aren't Toyota and didn't grow up with the Toyota thinking and management style are starting from, you know, a deficit position. And so Kaizen events to me are first and foremost a way to shape behavior. Yes, you get rapid results, but I kind of consider the, you know, the shaping behavior as a bigger benefit to Kaizen events than the rapid results. And so yeah, I just don't understand the naysaying that goes on around Kaizen events because they're wildly effective. I guess one thing I will say about the naysaying, one thing that people are correct about is that if organizations become what I call addicted to Kaizen events, where they only make improvement during a Kaizen event, well, that's of course just wrong. You want to build, you know, daily improvement into the culture, but that's not what I use Kaizen events for. I use them to build daily skill sets and so that organizations can perform that way, you know, in the years to come without having Kaizen events. It's to teach those behaviors.
So I could use Kaizen events to help me get out of organizational chaos.
Absolutely. I use it all. I mean, actually, every Kaizen event I've ever facilitated helps reduce chaos. It may be a very local level, but it absolutely reduces chaos.
You mentioned a lot of lean terms in the Toyota and the PDSA and things in your book, but do I need to be a lean company to benefit from the book?
No. In fact, you know, if you're a Six Sigma kind of company, then you could easily replace PDSA with DMAIC. Although, you know, there are certainly some benefits to PDSA and PDCA in that they're cyclical and DMAIC is linear, but we won't go into that.
Don't show any partiality here.
No. There are good reasons for my partiality. It is, you know, but that's another podcast. But you don't even have to be a Six Sigma company. I mean, you could be a company that doesn't have a formal methodology that you're using, and you're just using kind of common sense to make improvements. The challenge is making improvement on a cracked foundation. Businesses are trying to do that, and it's why improvement isn't any more successful than it is. So you have to rebuild that foundation, seal up those cracks by infusing greater clarity, focus, discipline, and engagement in the organization. And then any improvement will be far, far, far more successful.
Well, I was quite surprised with your Blue Angel ending, okay? Mm-hmm. I was an idiot. So, but I was more surprised when I got the appendix that referenced the Socratic questioning and Richard Paul, because I spent about 2 years of my life in a deep dive studying his work and other related work about it, and I thought it was a very interesting twist to bring that in at the end. Why did you do it?
The questions are actually a sidearm of the coaching piece that I talk about in the engagement section, because coaching is the ability, and actually during discipline as well, coaching is the necessary step in order to build the disciplined process for problem solving into an organization. You can't just learn it by reading a book. People need to be coached by someone who knows the process. And it also is a way to get deep engagement by having a coach and teaching people a skill set. So the coaching methodology that I learned had a lot of appreciative inquiry as part of it, so that you could break a coach's habit. And I was absolutely one of these people, type A personality, you know, I've got the answer. And when I was a manager in my early career, I absolutely was guilty of telling my employees what to do. And then, you know, fortunately, I had some good mentors that said, no, you need to help develop them, and you don't do that by telling them what to do. So what I have found in teaching coaches, for example, with A3 problem solving, the way to keep someone from telling people what to do is to teach them how to ask better questions and to use questions as a teaching methodology, not questions just for the questioning's sake, but questions that help the person realize that they're maybe on the wrong path or they may want to look over here. And so when I got into the questions, the Socratic questions, and that's how I bumped into Richard Paul. I actually had never heard of him until I did this book. So that's fascinating that you and studied him.
Karen, why don't you just expand a little bit without giving the ending of the book away about the Blue Angels?
Well, I looked for organizations outside of business that I felt were outstanding because, to be frank, I had a very difficult time finding a large number of businesses that I considered to be outstanding based on my definition. So I looked into the arts and sports and military, and the Blue Angels just kind of jumped out at me as being the organization in my worldview that is just consistently outstanding. So then I found myself a Blue Angel pilot and started getting a deep dive into their world and learned he spent so much time with me. He was very generous in helping me understand exactly why they're so outstanding. And sure enough, they have just this impeccable clarity about their show and what they're going to be doing every second of that show. And they just have, you know, clarity around their mission and all of that. They're extremely focused. I mean, there's probably no other organization I've heard that as a team maintains and demands the level of focus they do, from their pre-show and post-show briefings where no one is allowed in, and how they go about this whole routine they've got to stay focused on the show and then dissecting it afterwards. And then the disciplined approach they have toward training is just, you know, there's nothing like it. And they are very, very engaged, of course, you know, of necessity in what they do. So I'm a bit of a Blue Angels fan, and not a bit. I'm a huge fan of what they do.
Karen, is there something that you would like to add that maybe I did not ask?
Well, yeah, I think the one thing that it's important for every listener to understand is that while we're talking about organizational performance and organizational clarity and organizational focus, that all starts at an individual level and then, you know, to a department level or team group level, actually, department level, then division level. So it doesn't have to be the CEO of the organization declaring, we are going to become more outstanding than we are, and this is how we're going to do it. It doesn't have to be a top-down driven approach. It can be anybody who has any stake in an organization starting at their local level, even if it's just an employee that doesn't have any employees reporting to them, you know, asking questions to clarify and drawing people's attention to the fact that they're, you know, having a little bit of ADD going on and that type of thing. Supervisors and managers are in an ideal place to start driving these principles into their departments and their work teams. And then, of course, the further up the organization you go, the greater the gains will be, but it all starts one step at a time. So everyone can play a role in instilling clarity, focus, discipline, and engagement in their organization.
What is upcoming on your agenda?
I have my next book already in mind. It's an offshoot of this book, and I haven't really started sketching it out in detail yet because I'm, you know, busy promoting this book and frankly need to take a bit of a rest. And then I actually have another book in the works as well that'll be more of a how-to book with Productivity Press.
How can someone contact you?
Well, my website is ksmartin.com. That's S as in Sue, ksmartin.com. And you can, you know, find all the different ways to connect me on social media straight from the homepage on my website.
Okay. Is there a book website?
Yeah, it's actually part of my website. It's ksmartin.com and then /the-outstanding-organization. There. Yeah, you can click right on the homepage and get straight to the book page.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank you very much, Karen. I appreciate it very, very much. I think it was an outstanding podcast, and I look forward to hearing more about what you're up to.
Thanks, Joe. It was really nice talking with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. Visit us at theleanmarketinglab.com. Mm-hmm.